right. Well, good evening. Good to have you back here again this evening. Go ahead and have you turn in your Bibles right away to begin tonight to the book of Ecclesiastes. Lesson number 20 in our series, A Survey of the Old Testament, is the book of Ecclesiastes, another one of the wisdom books. Once you've gotten there, we'll go ahead and dive right in. The title of the book, well, it's Ecclesiastes. But what does Ecclesiastes mean, really? That's a rather big and unusual word in English, not one that you would pull out in everyday conversation, I would dare to say. But it is a good word, and it comes, if you trace it all the way back to the Hebrew Old Testament, it does come from the Hebrew. Koheleth, one who calls the people. That was the original title in the Hebrew Bible. When the Greek and Latin Old Testaments came along later, the languages translated this Hebrew title then into their own language. The English title is a transliteration of the Greek title. If you can read that, it says Ecclesiastes. You can hear the similarities between the two. Thus, the title Ecclesiastes means preacher. And if you look at your Bible, you might find that the book of Ecclesiastes, right below the title, Ecclesiastes also says the preacher. I don't know what kind of Bible you have, but I know that some do say that. The author gave himself this title, the preacher, several times in the book. And as we start, that's where I'd like to have you look at Ecclesiastes 1, or starting in the first verse, verses 1 and 2. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanity, saith the preacher. What vanity of vanity, all is vanity. And then again in verse 12 of the first chapter, I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. So in the first chapter, he uses this three times. He uses it several more times as he continues on throughout the book. And as we saw just from those three verses we read, the subtitle, as I've given this lesson tonight, Godless Life is Vanity. Vanity is a key theme in the book. And the summary of the book is Solomon is teaching from personal experience that living life apart from God is a complete waste. From personal experience, Solomon teaches that living life apart from God is a complete waste. And he really does a good job of walking through several ways that one can seek to live apart from God, always finding out and coming back to the fact that without him, it is vanity, vain, something that blows away in the breeze. But we'll get to that a little bit later. The author of the book, we know him as the preacher. We also know him as the son of David in verse 1 of chapter 1. And as well, in chapter 1, we find out he is the king ruling in Jerusalem. More specifically, the king ruling over Israel from Jerusalem. And really, that limits the possibilities quite a bit, because only one king ruled over a united Israel that wasn't David, that was a son of David, Solomon. And from this kind of deductive reasoning, we arrive at the conclusion that Solomon was the author. And if you continue reading till the very end of the book, in chapter 12 and verse 9, it's up there on the screen, he wrote many proverbs, which we know from last week, King Solomon was known throughout history for his wisdom and for writing the book of Proverbs. And moreover, because the preacher, there's that word, that title coming out yet again, was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yea, he gave good heed, and sought out, and set in order many proverbs. The progression of the book follows King Solomon's life. So, the key person, if you can assign a person to be the key person when there is no real name mentioned, would be Solomon, who is the author. And I believe that he is the key figure in the book of Ecclesiastes, because he is the preacher. He's the one who had the wisdom given from God and wanted to communicate it to the children of Israel. He is also one who had God-given wisdom that allowed him to perceive many difficult truths about life. Some of these, God gave him the wisdom to see right away, but others, it doesn't seem like he learned until he'd been through the school of hard knocks and had to figure out the problems that he was getting himself into. Solomon's own mistakes later in life allowed him to write with more wisdom gained from the school of experience. So if you follow Solomon's life, remembering how he started very well to serve God, he asked God for wisdom instead of riches, instead of power, instead of fame, honor, and God gave him all those things and wisdom, making him the wisest person who'd ever lived. But unfortunately, that wisdom seemed to have kind of died on the vine, because before he reached the end of his life, he forsook God and built idol houses, high places for the gods of his strange wives. And we're kind of supposing here, because the Bible doesn't strictly say this, but it kind of makes sense to suppose that Solomon might have, at the end of his life, when God then told him that he was going to get judged for sinning against God, for leaving the path of wisdom, we would say then that Solomon, realizing his folly, exercised wisdom once again and realized the vanity of his way of life. So we assign the date for the book shortly before 931 BC, which was when Solomon's reign ended, and after he forsook God and then probably came back later. The background for the book then is Solomon's life. If you understand Solomon's life, then you can really get a good grasp on where he's coming from in writing this book. Who was Solomon? If you go back to the very beginning, he is the son of King David and Bathsheba. Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah, that David killed because he had committed adultery with his wife. King Solomon was also the recipient of divine wisdom, greater wisdom than any other man has ever had, and it was known around the world. The Bible tells us how the Queen of Sheba came and asked King Solomon many very difficult questions, but he was able to answer them all satisfactorily, something that surprised her and then allowed her to take back more legends of his wisdom to her own people. And he was known around the world. People didn't want to fight him because they knew he had wisdom. Because he asked for that wisdom, God also gave him wealth, long life, and victory over his enemies. As a matter of fact, it probably wouldn't be an exaggeration to say he became the greatest king ever in Israel's history to date. You got to qualify that, because the Messiah will be the ultimate king in Israel's history, and he will be far greater than Solomon. But to date, King Solomon was the greatest in Israel's history, and his temple that he built to God is considered one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, with a marvelous fortune of gold and cedar wood, very valuable resources put into the building of this structure. He also, when he was done with the temple, then invested a great deal of time and resources into building his own palace, palaces for his wives, cities, making his kingdom great, making a name for himself. As a matter of fact, the wealth that he was pulling in every year that allowed him to do this was so great, the Bible says that silver was not considered valuable in Jerusalem during his reign. I don't know about you, but last time I checked, silver had some worth, not as much as gold, but to not be counted valuable, that's a lot of gold coming into the kingdom every year. It's impossible for us really to assign a value to how much he was getting. We did that when we were going through 1 and 2 Kings, but it was a very, very large amount. Solomon also, in developing these relationships with other countries that kept him in a peaceful society during his reign, took to himself 1,000 wives and concubines. Many of these are described as strange women, which, if you remember from last week, is a theme in the book of Proverbs, that the strange women will lead you astray. these strange women in Solomon's harem worshipped strange gods, and that led him astray at the end of his life. As he grew older, he also built high places for his wives who worshipped these gods, and he worshipped with them. Some of the gods that he built idols and high places for were extremely wicked, involving even as far as child sacrifice in their worship. So it was an abomination that Solomon allowed into the kingdom as he followed the leading of his strange wives. Then God delivered judgment and promised to take the United Kingdom from his successor. So then at that point, when Solomon realized that God was really going to judge him, and he began to see the adversaries that God raised up, that's the next point on the slide, that is when I believe that King Solomon realized the vanity of everything he had been doing. When he looked at the future, realizing his kingdom was going to be destroyed, or at least disintegrated into several different parts, squabbling factions, tribes, instead of a unified entity, he would have realized how vain his building up of his name had been, because it wasn't going to be carried on. And then he died after reigning for 40 years as king in Jerusalem. The key word, as I've already said, and really a key theme at the same time, is vanity. What is vanity? I mean, we know what it means, but have you ever given a thought to where it comes from, what the concept is behind it? The word translated vanity is the Hebrew word hebel, basically meaning vapor, a breath. If you breathe out, that's vanity. Because, oops, I don't know what happened there. That's vanity because it is there and gone, short. In a way, empty. Vanity. This word occurs 37 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, it's based on the ethereal nature of things we work on in this life. It is there to remind us that life really, in reality, is very short. 37 times in 12 chapters. That's a lot of emphasis on this one word, vanity. Average of 3 times a chapter. But the concept of vanity also comes up in a few other places in the Bible, not just the Old Testament. We could go back to the book of Job. You remember when we studied that, Job, at one point, as he was in his trials, realized that in all his affliction, his life was vanity because he was a short-lived man in the long scheme of things. Life was short, even for a man who lived 40 years after his kids were born again. And I have the verse up there when he says that he loathes life because he will not live always. Let me alone, for my days are vanity. My days are breath. Here a second, gone the next. Vanity. James 4:14. Let's go ahead and turn to the book of James. This is a verse that we read a lot, really, but it's another emphasis on the word vanity. James chapter 4. I've got verse 14, or the second half of verse 14 on the screen, but we'll start reading in verse 13. Go to now, ye that say, today or tomorrow, we will go into such a city and continue there a year, and buy and sell and get gain. Whereas ye know not what shall be on the morrow, for what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. Now the Hebrew word's not used here because the book of James was written in Greek. Now, but the concept is the same. The shortness of life. The concept of a vapor that when you put a kettle on to boil, you can see the vapor coming up out of the pot, but it's only there for a moment and then it's gone. That's what your life is like. Vanity. So, this concept of vanity is used by the preacher to describe all kinds of pursuits in the book of Ecclesiastes. Among these are wealth, seeking of riches, seeking of personal gain. Solomon would have been one to understand how much wealth can be empty. one of the richest men who ever lived. Honor, seeking to have the preeminence over other people through higher education or personal achievements. Solomon definitely had honor. The entire world knew who Solomon was. Known world at that time. That's an honored name because he had so much. Fame, wanting everyone to know who you are, how great of a person you are. Yeah, he had fame too. Pleasures, wanting a life that makes you feel good. Solomon had 1,000 wives and concubines. He lived for pleasure. It's pretty easy to say. And at the end, what did he find out about all of these things? He discovered that they're vanity. They're empty. They don't bring fulfillment in life. Are all kinds of pursuits truly vanity? If that's the perspective that the book of Ecclesiastes leaves us with, we have to ask that question. Are they truly vanity? And so we will continue on then with the challenges to Ecclesiastes. And this is a challenge to Ecclesiastes because when you read the book, it can almost sound like, well, there is no purpose in life. Why bother then? And the reason is, really, in a nutshell, that that summary statement that I gave you at the beginning, godless life is vanity. And Solomon comes back to this point at the end of his book, but all throughout the beginning and for the majority, he is speaking from the perspective of someone who believes life is all about these things. Someone who dedicates his life to seeking pleasure, wealth, fame, honor, whatever it might be. And he described this worldview very accurately because he had lived with it. When we understand the vanity of life without God, we will be motivated to live wisely with eternity in view. That is the reason why Solomon has written this book, so we can take a look at the vanity he experienced and apply it to our own lives, realizing then what it truly means to have a fulfilled life. The book of Ecclesiastes is pretty short, only 12 chapters, but it has a lot of truth in it. The introduction, he begins by introducing who he is, his relationship to the people in Jerusalem, and for the first half of the book, he investigates life, and he arrives at the vanity of seeking pleasure, the vanity of wisdom and folly, the vanity of material gain. All these things just kind of boil down to one word for Solomon, and that is vanity. And at the end of investigating life, finding out what the end of all these things is, Solomon decides that in his conclusions, man's wisdom is limited and the unknowns beyond death really make life vanity. You get the theme of vanity. It's just all throughout this book. So at the very end, Solomon's final advice. Let's go ahead and turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 12 and we will read these few verses. We'll actually look at verses 13 and 14, which are the summary of the whole book, really. It's like a really long-winded preacher who had a lot to say, and finally, when he gets down to his conclusion, he's really got one point, and he can say it in a single sentence. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. So if you live life remembering that God is in fact a part of life, then it's not vanity because God will bring it all into judgment, and that is our duty to serve God. The key doctrine that we find in the book of Ecclesiastes is that God designed life to be fulfilling only when he is at its center. Everyone has a feeling of emptiness in the soul from the moment they are born. And it drives every single person who has ever lived to try to fill it. When you ache, you try to take care of the ache. And deep inside the heart of every person, there is an ache without God. If you look throughout history, people have tried to fill that ache with various things, really. Some people in a more primitive culture worship spirits. They try to get good luck. Some people, if you move on a little bit further in life, in history, they have moved out of the primitive culture and they're starting to build empires. So they're trying to get fame and honor. That's what they've dedicated their life to, hoping that it will bring them fulfillment. Then some people, as you move along further throughout history, have everything they could possibly want. But because they have everything they want, they desire more. They want more stuff, hoping that that stuff will give fulfillment. But all of these aches, these empty feelings, are an aspect of vanity when God is not at the center of life. This feeling is caused by sin. Because of sin, everyone is born with the gnawing feeling of emptiness in his soul. This empty feeling drives us to pursue something with all of our might. Solomon tried unsuccessfully to fill that hole with knowledge, wealth, honor, fame, pleasure, whatever somebody who has an unlimited supply of money wants to pursue to fill the aching feeling of emptiness. That was Solomon's life. He tried to pursue all these, but without God, he found out life is always vanity. And so, we come to application tonight. And that is, in a question, are you pursuing vanity? A message from Solomon. Let's turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 1. This is what Solomon wanted to leave as kind of a postscript on his life. What he wanted people to learn from his experiences with vanity. Chapter 1, 13 through 14. It's on the screen, but we'll also read it. And I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of man to be exercised therewith. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. And he goes on to say, there's nothing new under the sun. It's all been done. Been there, done that. And it's all vanity. Do you believe Solomon? You know, sometimes those vain pursuits can be deceitful. Not only do we find initially that they can be enjoyable, but while we are enjoying them, we are blind to the long-term impacts. Furthermore, the drive to pursue these pleasures is able to dull our senses to the pangs of conscience when we sin in order to meet that goal, that desire. I think Solomon probably at the beginning of his life would have been absolutely horrified if he'd thought ahead and thought that at some point in time he might be turning on God. But as time went on and he found out that marrying this daughter of Pharaoh here could bring him peace with Pharaoh for a time, and then marrying this daughter of so-and-so in the north, this daughter from over here, this daughter from this king down south in the north, east, south, west, you know, wherever they're coming from. And then God had also told him not to multiply wives, especially not from the children of the land, because those people would drive their hearts away from him. I imagine at first Solomon thought, you know, I probably shouldn't be doing this, but, you know, peace or a wife, I'll take peace. And as he continues to maybe sear his conscience, you can see how the step-by-step-by-step process leads to, in the end, not only building the high places for his wives to worship their gods, their strange gods, but also participating in the worship with him, with them. Ecclesiastes 2, verse 17. Let's go ahead and look at that verse as well. King Solomon said, therefore I hated life, because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous unto me, for all is vanity and vexation of spirit. when we come down to it, we're left with King Solomon's final advice at the end of the book. Let us fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. We've already read that verse, chapter 12 and verse 13. But let's look at the concept of fearing God again. I think it's worth reviewing this. What does it mean to fear God? You remember we discussed it last week as we looked through the book of Proverbs. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And if the book of Ecclesiastes and the book of Proverbs are both books dedicated to finding that wisdom, what is the fear of God, the fear of the Lord? Let's turn to Isaiah chapter 6. A little bit of background on this chapter, Isaiah chapter 6, the prophet Isaiah has been caught up to the heavenly throne room in seeing a vision. And he describes this vision in chapter 6 of Isaiah. We'll start reading in verse 3. The seraphims that he is seeing flying around the throne room are crying something about the king, about the God they are serving. And one cried unto another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And the posts of the door moved at the voice of him that cried, and the house was filled with smoke. When you look at the fear of the Lord, it is a real fear. And it starts with knowing who God is. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the holy is understanding. When you know who God is, and you know that he is a holy king who has the power to judge, we then are left with Isaiah's response, which should be our response. If we look in verse 5, Isaiah said, "Woe is me, for I am undone, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For mine eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." When we see who God is as a holy king, who has the power to not only judge us, but to completely destroy us because we have offended his holiness, we then recognize who we are, and that is undone, sinful people. And that is fear, because we do deserve to be destroyed by God. Let us fear God. When we fear God, when we recognize that we deserve to be destroyed forever in hell because of our sin, then we will keep his commandments, because that is how we please him. We love God. We keep his commandments. This is the whole duty of man. We recognize who he is, a holy king who can judge men. We recognize who then we are, sinful human beings who deserve to be destroyed for offending a holy God. And in keeping his commandments, three things will happen. First, we'll live holy lives without the regrets caused by sin. Think about King Solomon. What if he had made a choice somewhere along the line that he was done following the path of vanity and had decided that he wanted to live in the path of wisdom, forsaking all those vain things and live with God at the center of his life instead of making compromises here, compromises there? He wouldn't have had all the regrets of pursuing a life of vanity when he got to the end. Secondly, we will also find that God satisfies the true need of our hearts. Since God is the one who created us, he is more than able to meet every part of our needs, and that includes our spiritual needs. The knowledge of God can fill that aching emptiness in the soul. And the third thing that will happen when we keep his commandments is we will find that if God gives us the other things that we could be seeking, the things that Solomon dedicated his life to seeking, so wealth, honor, fame, pleasure, if God does see fit to give us those things, we will be able to use them in a way that is, in fact, fulfilling because we are following God. Having those things does not mean that they are vanity all the time if we are using them for God, because he is at the center of our lives. But all this only works if we follow Solomon's last command at the end of the book to fear God and keep his commandments, because this is the whole duty of man. Thank you very much for coming tonight. Let's go ahead and divide up for prayer.